All right, y'all, we are going to jump back into the story of Gideon, looking at the second part of it. If you remember last week in chapter 6, we looked at the oppression that they were dealing with from the Midianites. Almost said the Mennonites. They're an oppressive bunch. But that the nature of their oppression was largely not military, but an economic oppression, basically doing a kind of a scorched earth policy of coming in and just taking all the crops, livestock, you know, everything, and just basically thoroughly demoralized and weakened the people. And it was a dangerous place.
Referencing back to, you know, the Exodus, and I was thinking the other day about that being similar to the plagues and the locusts.
Exactly. Because actually one of the places in chapter 7, it referred to the Midianites as like locusts on the land. Well, they cried out. I heard that. And so they cried out, and God sent a prophet first, before he called Gideon. He sent a prophet first, basically to tell them why this was happening. He was dealing with the spiritual issue first, before he sent a deliverer. But then the angel of the Lord appeared to Gideon, and as he is threshing his grain in a wine press to hide it from the Midianites. And the angel interestingly declares him, and a lot of people think this is a sarcastic statement, but I don't think it is. They declared him, who was the least son and the weakest clan in Manasseh, which was a minor tribe, declared him to be a man of valor. And after interacting with Gideon and miraculously proving to him that it was in fact the Lord speaking, Gideon fearfully but obediently pulled down the altar of Baal. He did it fearfully because he did it at night. But he pulled down the altar of Baal and the Asherah pole that the people had erected on his father's land. And after receiving two different signs from God, both involving a fleece, he gets ready to move. And this week we now move into the victory of the Midianites and the underlying spiritual issues in this battle, and then Gideon's poor finish after the victory. So first of all, as we start with chapter 7, it says, "Then Jerubbaal, that is Gideon, and all the people who were with him rose early and encamped beside the spring of Herod." It appears there were like 32,000 people that he had called up. And the camp of Midian was north of them by the hill of Morah in the valley. The Lord said to Gideon, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over me, saying, 'My own hand has saved me.' Now therefore proclaim in the ears of the people, say, 'Whoever is trembling, fearful and trembling, let him return home and hurry away from Mount Gilead.' Then 22,000 of the people returned and 10,000 remained." Now, before we go any further, verse 2 is the biggest point of this entire chapter. It is the main point of the entire chapter. All of this winnowing down of the army is because of what God says in verse 2. That he wants the glory for the victory. He said, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites." It basically said, "The people with you are too many for me to give the Midianites into their hand, lest Israel boast over the saying, 'My own hand has saved me.'" He not only wants the glory, but the main thing is he wants Israel to see. He wants them to see that it was from his hand miraculously that protected and delivered them. The main thing to get in this whole thing is to understand God's overriding purposes in this. Because he makes it clear to deal with the hearts of his people. That's what he's trying to do. That's why he sent a prophet first to explain the nature of their problem. That was a true spiritual problem, not a bunch of Midianites by itself. It was so this whole battle was not a military operation so much as it was a pastoral lesson. It was a teaching moment. That's what we like to refer to that. You know, you got some issue with your kids, this is a teaching moment. And that's what he was basically doing here. And the whole point, and actually his point of the whole affair, going all the way back to the oppression from Midian and then the battle, was to teach Israel to trust him. Because why were they going after the Baals? Because they didn't trust that God would take care of them. He wanted Israel to trust him, to see his power, and to follow him wholeheartedly. So, starting at verse 4. And the Lord said to Gideon, "The people are still too many." He had 10,000 left. "Take them down to the water, and I will test them for you there. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This one shall go with you,' shall go with you. And anyone of whom I say to you, 'This shall not go with you,' shall not go." So he brought the people down to the water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "Everyone who laps the water with his tongue, as a dog laps, you shall set by himself. Likewise, everyone who kneels down to drink." And the number of those who lapped, putting their hands to their mouths, was 300 men. But all the rest of the people knelt down to drink water. And the Lord said to Gideon, "With the 300 men who lapped, I will save you and give the Midianites into your hand, and let all the others go every man to his home." So the people took provisions in their hands and their trumpets, and he sent all the rest of Israel, every man to his tent, but retained the 300 men. And the camp of Midian was below him in the valley. Now, what were y'all taught growing up about the 300 men who lapped, pulling the water to their mouths? What were y'all taught, if y'all were taught the same thing I was? Why did God do that?
Well, Bill Gothard says it was 300 men were watchful.
Exactly. That's what I was taught growing up. Bill Gothard taught that there was the character lesson of alertness to be seen in that. Did y'all ever hear that growing up?
Heard it in Bill Gothard.
Yeah. I had actually heard it before Bill Gothard, but yeah, I know he taught that. But I'd actually heard it growing up myself in my nice Methodist church as a little kid. And I went to. Well, many think it was because that they could look around and be alert, and it gave them special praise for their character and virtue. And there was the additional character lesson that you teach the kids to always be alert. But this way of drinking in the passage is never mentioned as virtuous. And it had no application to the battle. Do you see anywhere in the battle where it says, you know, how the importance was to be alert? It's not anywhere necessarily in there.
Maybe it's because they were old and weren't very flexible, couldn't kneel down all the way.
There you go. That could be. Tight hamstrings. You know? You know? But that lesson, that character virtue lesson, has to be completely read into the text. It's not there. It has to be completely read. And that's eisegesis, not exegesis. The mechanism of separating the men out was merely God's method for lessening the number, because that was his objective. His objective was to make it as few people as possible, and that's how he did it.
So how does that look?
Well, you know, a dog goes, but the thing is, that, it seems like it, I will say when I read that, it was confusing to me. Because when I think of a dog lapping, I think of the dog sticking its head all the way down into the water. Yeah, I mean, but those are the people he sent away.
Yeah, that's what I was
thinking. It would be impossible for me to drink from a stream without
how does, I mean, I could do it, I guess, on all fours and lean down.
That's what I think.
That would be less watchful and more awkward.
Well, that's the things that, the way I understood it after trying to read through it the best I could, was that the people who got sent away were the ones who got down on all fours and leaned all the way over with their face to the water. Whereas the other ones pulled water up to them with their hand. I mean, that's the only way I could make sense of it. But
if you're saying it's completely random.
Yeah.
I mean, it's God just separating the people. He wants less, and that's really the point.
Right. Yeah. It could have been, he could have picked the left-handed instead of the right-handed. Mm-hmm. Or, you know, people who have lace-up boots instead of slip-on. I mean, you know, he could have picked anything. But it was merely God's method for lessening the number. Because if you look further on into the battle, he never even says that they will be the most skilled soldiers, does he? He doesn't say, pick your strongest and bravest, or these are the most alert, or these are the most skilled. It doesn't have anything to do with it. So, then, starting at verse 9, says, that same night, the Lord said to him, arise, go down against the camp, for I have given it into your hand. But if you are afraid to go down to the camp with Purah, your servant, and you shall hear what they say, and afterward your hands shall be strengthened to go down against the camp. Then he went down with Purah, his servant, to the outposts of the armed men who were in the camp. And the Midianites and the Amalekites and all the people of the east lay along the valley like locusts in abundance, as we talked about Barry there at the beginning. Their camels were without number as the sand that is on the seashore in abundance. And when Gideon came, behold, a man was telling a dream to his comrade. So I'm assuming he's on now the outskirts of the camp, probably a couple of just like the guards or something like that. And he said, behold, I dreamed a dream, and behold, a cake of barley bread tumbled into the camp of Midian and came to the tent and struck it so that it fell and turned it upside down, and the tent lay flat. So, and his comrade answered, this is no other than the sword of Gideon, the son of Joash, a man of Israel. God has given into his hand Midian and all the camp. So God has been preparing the hearts of the Midianites be defeated. And we see, you know, a cake of barley bread, that's just a very humble, small thing, knocking over a whole tent, turning it upside down. So, as soon as Gideon heard the telling of the dream and its interpretation, he worshipped, which is also really cool. He didn't go off and worship. He worshipped right there where he was, probably in a very precarious spot, listening from the other side of the bushes or a rock from the guys at the camp, but he worshiped right there. He was moved to worship God. And he returned to the camp of Israel and said, arise, for the Lord has given the host of Midian into your hand. So it emboldened his spirit. He is encouraged. He is given great courage, because throughout all this, he is never shown to be really a very courageous guy. He's a very, you know, very, not very stout-hearted person. And then in verse 16, and he divided the 300 men into three companies, 100 each, and he put trumpets into the hands of all of them and empty jars with torches inside the jars. Now, I would understand, Dr. Phelps, I would understand that to mean that with the torches inside the jars, he was basically able to hide the light from the torches. Yeah. And he said to them, look at me and do likewise. So he's really taking a leadership role here. He's not just going to give orders. He's going to lead into battle. When I come to the outskirts of the camp, do as I do. When I blow the trumpet, I and all who are with me, then blow the trumpets also on every side. So what they're doing is they are surrounding them. You know, they're at least going to be on three sides at least. But they are surrounding them. You know, all the camp, and shout for the Lord and for Gideon. And I do think it's significant that the shout that they're supposed to say is for the Lord and for Gideon. You can really interpret that a couple of different ways. One is he's lifting himself up, you know, creating kind of a cult of personality. But on the other hand, he also knows the dream that those people heard, or that those people had, and the interpretation that the Midianites themselves had, that this is none other than Gideon. So he's associating it with that dream to, even though he knows it's the Lord doing this, he's feeding that fear that's going on. That's just, it doesn't really say what the interpretation of that is supposed to be, but there could be a little bit of both in there. I don't know. So Gideon and 100 men who were with him came to the outskirts of the camp at the beginning of the middle watch. Now, when is the beginning of the middle watch? The middle watch is from midnight to 4 a.m. It's the middle watch of the night. So it's basically at midnight, middle of the night. Everybody's probably sleeping except the guards. So people are not going to be at their most ready. And it's the darkest. And it's at the beginning of the middle watch when they had just set the watch. And they blew the trumpets and smashed the jars that were in their hands. And then the three companies blew the trumpets and broke the jars. They held in their left hands the torches, and in their right hands the trumpets to blow. And they cried out, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." What are they not holding? Swords. Doesn't it? I mean, there's nothing in here that says they're carrying weapons, even. Every man stood in his place around the camp, and notice that every man stood in his place around the camp. They weren't running into the camp. They were standing in place outside the camp. And all the army ran. They cried out and fled. When they blew the 300 trumpets, the Lord set every man's sword against his comrade. They start just killing each other. It's utter chaos. Because what has happened is you have the loud sound of 300 jars being broken, the crashing of 300 jars being broken all at once. You have a flash of light coming up out of the midnight darkness, about 300 torches in directions all around the camp. Trumpets blowing, 300 trumpets. Now, if you think about this, usually in an army, there's only going to be a certain number of people blowing trumpets. Most everyone else is going to be fighting. So if you're thinking 300 trumpets, there's got to be an enormous army. But there's not. But it gives the illusion of a much greater army that's going on. And then there's the cry, "A sword for the Lord and for Gideon." So they have clearly associated that this is Israel coming to attack. And as it says, the Lord had already prepared the hearts of the Midianites, put fear in their hearts. So they ended up turning their own swords against themselves. And the army fled as far as Bethshitta toward Zerera, as far as the border of Abel Meholah by Tabith. And the men of Israel were called out from Naphtali and from Asher and from all Manasseh, which is Gideon's tribe, is Manasseh. And they pursued after Midian. Then, and we have to note here that Gideon and his 300 men were not really fighters. They didn't fight. They were merely pursuers. of them, because the Midianites were in a panic, utter panic. But then it says in verse 24, you know, as he's calling these other tribes to help, especially Ephraim, he sent messengers throughout all the hill country of Ephraim, saying, "Come down against the Midianites and capture the waters against them, as far as Bethbara and also the Jordan." So all the men of Ephraim were called out, and they captured the waters as far as Bethbara and also the Jordan. Now what that means is, that is the direction the Midianites were going to be fleeing. They were going to be trying to get out and get back to their territory. And what they did was, by Ephraim coming and taking the waters, they trapped them. They were basically had them in a vice grip. They had them captured. And they captured the two princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. They killed Oreb at the rock of Oreb, and Zeb they killed at the winepress of Zeb. Then they pursued Midian, and they brought the heads of Oreb and Zeb to Gideon across the Jordan. So Ephraim had great success in their particular aspect of the mission. Now we get to chapter 8, and it becomes kind of from all this great stuff, it becomes kind of a mixture of good and bad, and then it ends up bad. We have to understand here that Gideon, besides his own fearfulness, he had basically three opponents to deal with in this entire camp that he had to overcome in the strength of God. One was Baal, which was the pulling down of the altar of Baal. He had to deal with Baal worship in Israel. So he had to do that. And his father, if you remember from last week, defended him, saying, "We'll let Baal contend for himself," which actually became Gideon's new name, Jerubbaal, which is, you know, "Let Baal contend." So it was the false god he had to deal with. Then he had to deal with the oppressor nation, which is Midian. Well, now he deals with his third opponent, which is Israel itself. Israel itself turns against him. It says, "The men of Ephraim said to him, 'What is this that you have done to us, not to call us when you went to fight against Midian?' And they accused him fiercely. And he said to them, 'What have I done now in comparison with you?'" He's kind of working them a little bit. "What have I done now in comparison with you? Is not the gleaning of the grapes of Ephraim better than the grape harvest of Abiezer? God has given into your hands the princes of Midian, Oreb and Zeb. What have I been able to do in comparison with you?" So he's just pacifying their ego. "Then their anger against him subsided when he said this." See, they were upset at Gideon for not consulting them first. They claim, see, the tribe of Ephraim claimed Joshua as one of their own. He was of the tribe of Ephraim. And they seem to have more than a little bit of what we would call prideful hubris going on. They wanted to be at the center of the action. They thought they were kind of a prima donna. And we'll see in Judges chapter 12, they do a very similar thing. They want to be in the center of the action. They want to be where it's happening. At the beginning of chapter 12, when Jephthah is the judge involved, it says, "The men of Ephraim were called to arms, and they crossed to Zaphon and said to Jephthah, 'Why did you cross over to fight against the Ammonites and did not call us to go with you? We will burn your house over you with fire.'" They're willing to kill him because they didn't get called into the battle too. So there was some serious ego going on with Ephraim. And depending on how you look at it, Gideon either very deftly or very weakly deals with them, pacifies them. How should he have answered them? If he was a stronger leader, how should he have answered them? Dr. Phil says, "It's not about you." You know, said, "I didn't pick the warriors. God did." God wanted 300. And in fact, what he was dealing with in Ephraim, Ephraim wanted to be able to say, we won the battle. God wanted to be able to say, I won the battle, not you. So he was, in fact, he could have explained to them, no, what you're saying is exactly what God did not want to happen. He wants to teach you that he is the one who wins the battle and not you. He didn't proclaim that truth. You don't see a lot of proclamation anywhere from Gideon. He's doing what God wants him to do fearfully, but doing it, but he's not really doing much proclaiming of truth. You get down to it throughout this whole story. So then, in the next section, Gideon came to the Jordan and crossed over. They're still pursuing. They're exhausted, but still pursuing the Midianites. They're in the Trans-Jordan area now. So he said to the men of Sukkoth, please give loaves of bread to the people who follow me, for they are exhausted, and I am pursuing after Zeba and Zalmunna, the kings of Midian. And the officials of Sukkoth, this is more opposition from within Israel, the officials of Sukkoth said, are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand that we should give bread to your camp? What are they saying there? What they're doing is they're explaining, they are acting out of fear rather than obedience or any national loyalty to Israel. What they're afraid of, because you remember, like, particularly like in very fiercely contested areas during like World War II or anywhere else, a city could be taken by one side and then taken back by the other side and then taken by the other side, and it would just go from back and forth and back and forth over this same piece of land over and over and over again before the battle is finally won. And what they're afraid of is, if we give you aid, if we lose this land again and they come back in, they're going to wreak vengeance on us for helping you. So we're not going to help you. They tried to become Switzerland, basically, even though they weren't allowed to be Switzerland because they were part of Israel. And Gideon said in verse 7, well then, when the Lord has given Zeba and Zalmunna into my hand, I will flail your flesh with the thorns of the wilderness and with briars. So he's going to bring judgment on them when he comes back. And from there he went up to Penuel and spoke to them in the same way. And the men of Penuel answered him as the men of Sukkoth had answered. So they didn't offer any help either. And he said to the men of Penuel, when I come again in peace, I will break down this tower. So he's going to bring a different type of judgment on them. Now, Zeba and Zalmunna were in Karkor with their army, about 15,000 men, all who were left of the army of the people of the east. Look at this. For there had fallen 120,000 men who drew the sword, and there were only 15,000 left. At that point, almost 90% of the army were gone. But it doesn't really, other than the military aspects that happened with Ephraim, other than that, a whole lot of that must have been literally Midian turning on themselves. And Gideon went up by the way of the tent dwellers east of Nobah, and, oh, that's a great word, Jogbeha, and attacked the army, for the army felt secure. And Zeba and Zalmunna fled, and he pursued and captured the two kings of Midian, Zeba and Zalmunna, and he threw all the army into a panic. And then Gideon, the son of Joash, returned from the battle by the ascent of Heretz, and he captured a young man of Sukkoth and questioned him. And he wrote down for him the officials and elders of Sukkoth, 77 men. By the way, notice the payback that he gives to Sukkoth and Penuel. He does before he kills the kings of Midian. Mm-hmm. He basically is going to show them, yes, I do have the kings of Midian, like I said I would. And he came to the men of Succoth and said, "Behold, Zeba and Zalmunna, about whom you taunted me, saying, 'Are the hands of Zeba and Zalmunna already in your hand, that we should give bread to your men who are exhausted?' And he took the elders of the city," he had all their names, "and he took thorns of the wilderness and briars, and with them taught the men of Succoth a lesson."
You're here.
Yeah. "And he broke down the Tower of Penuel and killed the men of that city." Now, Dr. Phillips, when it says he taught them a lesson, do you think that he killed the elders of Succoth, or do you think he just beat them soundly?
I think he probably beat them. You know, I mean, that was certainly a legitimate punishment.
Oh, yeah. But it's interesting that with one he inflicted death, and it appears the other he did not. Then he said in verse 18 to Zeba and Zalmunna, "Where are the men whom you killed at Tabor?" They answered, "As you are, so were they. Every one of them resembled the son of a king." And he said, "They were my brothers, the sons of my mother, and as the Lord lives, if you had saved them alive, I would not kill you." So he said to Jether, his firstborn, "Rise and kill them." But the young man did not draw the sword, for he was afraid because he was still a young man. Now there's one aspect of this, why he had his son. He called upon his son to do that. I think this is going to play a little bit into what we see later when there's the ephod that gets built and are made and their desire to make him a ruler over them. I think Gideon sends very mixed signals, because one of the aspects of the ruler, the king ruler, is it's hereditary. It goes down from generation to generation. So there's a sense in which he calls his son to do that. He's trying to give his son street cred to the other tribes. But the son would not do that. He was afraid because he was young. And then Zeba and Zalmunna said, "Rise yourself and fall upon us, for as the man is, so is his strength." And Gideon arose and killed Zeba and Zalmunna, and he took the crescent ornaments that were on the necks of their camels. So he starts getting a little of the booty for himself here. And then this is where Gideon really starts to fall. And at one level, it looks very honorable what he says to them, but it's a mixed message. And a lot of commentators there's a lot of conflict, not anger conflict, but there's differing opinions on what he's actually saying here. It says, "Then the men of Israel said to Gideon, 'Rule over us, you and your son and your grandson also.'" They're wanting to set him up as a king, because that's the aspect of kingship. It's generational. "For you have saved us from the hand of Midian." Gideon said to them, "I will not rule over you, and my son will not rule over you. The Lord will rule over you." Now on the surface, that looks very correct. You know, the Lord will rule. But remember, the book of Judges is also an apologetic for having a king. It's making the case for having a king. It could be that he truly did not want to rule, that he could have been saying man would not make the ruler, God would, or God will rule himself, that God will pick the king and anoint the king, not the people. This isn't an election. But some of the stuff he does is like that of someone who wants to be king, in the way he called his son to try and execute those kings of Midian. And also, he also says he is looking at it clearly from a kingship standpoint, because he says, "Neither me nor my son." So in a sense, he is saying he doesn't want to be the king. But it also said, though he didn't want to, he still got a very large bounty. And it says here, because... And Gideon said to them, "Let me make a request of you. Every one of you give me the earrings from his spoil." For they had golden earrings because they were Ishmaelites, the Midianites did. And they answered, "We will willingly give them." And they spread a cloak, and every man threw in it the earrings from his spoil. And the weight of the golden earrings that he requested was 1,700 shekels. Now a shekel is about... maybe about 6 ounces. It's about 2/5 of an ounce is what it says. So somebody can do the math and figure out, but it's a lot. It's a lot. 1,700 shekels is a lot of gold. Besides the crescent ornaments and the pendants and the purple garments worn by the kings of Midian, and besides the collars that were around the necks of their camels. So he still got this large bounty. And one other thing that we can see further, I'm skipping ahead a little bit because it connects to it. When it says Jeroboam went to his own house in verse 29, now Gideon had 70 sons, his own offspring, for he had many wives. That was also common of kings. That was also very common of kings to have a lot of wives. And his concubine, who was in Shechem, also bore him a son, and he called his name Abimelech. Do y'all know what the name Abimelech means? Remember, he named his son Abimelech. The name Abimelech means, "My father is king." Mm-hmm. So we can see some very mixed messages that he sent out. And we will also, in the next chapter, next time we meet, we will see Abimelech using the logic of being a son of Gideon to aspire to kingship. Because he actually blatantly says he wants to be the king. But then we see the ephod that he made in verse 27. And Gideon made an ephod of it, and put it in his city, in Ophrah. And all Israel whored after it there. And it became a snare to Gideon and to his family. So Midian was subdued before the people of Israel, and they raised their heads no more. And the land had rest 40 years in the days of Gideon. Now, as we see, this ephod was made from gold of the booty from the Midianites. And what is an ephod? It was a type of tunic garment that was part of the priestly attire. It was specifically related to the priesthood. It reflected his desire to be an ongoing source of divine guidance and leadership instead of for a fixed time. Like, I want to go to my place and be in peace. You know, he still makes that to kind of be an image of his ongoing guidance and leadership position in Israel. And it became a stumbling block and a snare to Gideon, because it says they whored after it, which means they treated it as if it were an idol, that it had some kind of mojo about it, had special significance spiritually. He made that himself. He was not commanded to do that by God. He did it himself. So it was an aspiration to move into an area that was not his calling. And this is a lesson for all of us. We are prone as men to want to look for more than what God has already provided us for guidance and for assurance. He's given us things to guide us. He's given us things to assure us, reassure us. What has He given us? First of all, He's given us His Word, right? His Word. To guide us and to reassure us. He's given us His sacraments. That's what baptism is. It is a sign and a seal. It is an assurance to us that He is faithful to His covenant promises. And that's what the table is. The sacrament. The table is a reminder. As in the Old Testament, circumcision and the Passover. That were to be readily observed. That God is with us. He has not left us. We are His people. Those are for us, but We always want to look for more, right? We want a special word from the Lord. How many times have we heard that? A special one from the Lord. It's extra. That's what not what God has given us.
When you said that they played the harlot, was it just actual ephod, or was it Gideon himself? Like they were?
Well, it said it was a snare to his family as well. So I'm assuming it was all of them. If it had only said it was to the rest of Israel or something, we could have said it was everybody. It looks like Gideon was part of it as well. But it does say, despite that, Israel had peace for 40 years until Gideon's death. And it said Midian never rose its head again against them. Now, what is significant here, when it said, and you wouldn't see this unless you read through the rest of Judges, you know, in the past, there's been this pattern of, you know, Israel falls into sin, God raises up a deliverer, defeats the enemy, and then they have peace for a period of time, right? We've seen that in every other case. This is the last place in the book of Judges where you see, and they had peace. There was a progressive decline that was going on during the book of Judges. We can say that, yes, there was a deliverance. There was this. But it was still trending downward. There was a descent morally and practically in Israel during this entire time, because they were not, after this, once Abimelech rises and they start having all the stuff go on with that, they never had peace again in the book of Judges. So they were in a period of progressive decline. It wasn't just a steady state where they had just ups and downs. Are there any other thoughts or any other comments?
Power tends to corruption.
Yes. That's a lesson.
And we see that with Gideon. So, you know, there's lots of, there's Israel, there's Gideon, there's his family and all the problems. You know, he's multiplying the wives to himself, looking like a king. In competition with you know, the foreign kings.
Mm-hmm.
You know, he brings his ephod to Ophrah to exalt his city, which was otherwise, you know, insignificant, to try to make it great and make, you know, to make it sort of the center of, like the center of Israel instead of well, Jerusalem, of course, at this point really wasn't
mm-hmm.
the center of Israel. You know, the worship was still at the tabernacle. And so it was, you know, a lot of strange things obviously happening here. But still, we have a very few biblical figures, and Gideon certainly one of these many, that in place of leadership, who also were not notably sinful. And, of course, that's before and after we get kings, or even enhanced after you get the kings.
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, men are always men, and they were always sinful.
Mm-hmm.
And the point, of course, for the way God achieved the victory through Gideon was that God would be exalted. And, of course, that's very quickly lost, not only by Israel, but by Gideon himself.
Yep.
So in Hebrews 11, it says, "What more shall I say?
Yep.
For time would fail me to tell of Gideon and Barak,
sure.
Samson and Jephthah." And I guess I take from that that as sinful as we are, God uses us. Still uses
yep.
us.
Yep.
And there's positive talk of giving.
Right. Well, been a great faith.
Yeah. Well, I thought about that a lot this week. Not only as I was studying this, but I had a couple of different I don't know what you want to call it. A couple of different things happened during the course of this week with me Now, one of the things that y'all all know, or most of y'all know, Dr. R.C. Sproul died this week. And he was, you know, of the last 50 years, could be said that he brought more people to the Reformed faith than any one man. He was the gateway drug for more people to become Reformed in their theology. And for that matter, a lot of people would just come into the faith, period. And he died. He lived a faithful life. He's a good man. Not a perfect man. I would never claim that he was a perfect man. He would not claim to be a perfect man. But he was a largely very, very faithful guy. And you know, his last sermon was preached like right after Thanksgiving. Just 2 to 3 weeks before he died. Which is significant. And I mean, his last few years, he was having to preach with an oxygen tank in the pulpit to make it through. So he stayed faithful to the end. And I contrast that with a number of people that I know, some well, some not very well, who have let themselves be drawn into a cult of personality and have fallen, some very publicly. That are, you know, not far off in age from me, maybe even younger than me, who are basically, they and their wives are living separate lives now, or divorced, or basically their family is shipwrecked. And one of the big stumbling blocks that they had to deal with in their life and did not deal with it well was, as I said, the cult of personality that we are so prone to want to put people up on pedestals, rule over us, tell us what to do. We look to you as this great wisdom. And even people who have been largely faithful can make stupid mistakes, some gross and heinous, some just just general lack of wisdom or a little bit too much hubris. And discouraging thing to me. It was a discouraging thing to me because some of these guys were very close friends of mine. And when it says elsewhere in Scripture, you know, those who teach and lead, you know, will be doubly judged, that's something to be really taken seriously. Even as parents, the children that we're responsible for as parents, granted, we can't make a child repent, we can't make a child believe, but not only are we accountable to God for what we teach our children and how we train our children, but trust me, your children will judge you for it when you grow up. When they grow up, there will be a period of time where it's a lot of explaining to you all the things that you did wrong. And then it generally moderates over time. But there's double accountability there. So it's a humbling thing. To look at Gideon's story as a humbling thing. To not aspire to be faithful. Don't aspire to just be in charge. Are there any other thoughts or comments? Okay. Bill, can you close us in prayer?
Heavenly Father, we thank you for your word and for the examples that we have in it. Pray that you help us to live by faith. Help us to be like Gideon and following you and acting in faith. But I pray also you protect us.